Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. All right. I am so thrilled to welcome Dr. Kelly Flanagan to the podcast today. I have recently finished his newest book, True Companions, a book for everyone about the relationships that see us through. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, Alexis. Thanks for having me.
Now, I said recently, because I shared with you before we hit record, that there are occasions when I finish the book like the morning of the interview. But when I started this one a couple of weeks ago, I was at the pool and I thought, this is going to be a great read. I'm having a great time. And I mean, I was laughing, right, when I was reading, you know, parts of it. But parts of it, I was like trying to not cry at the pool. And I thought, I know myself well enough. I better give myself a few days to process before I sit down with a therapist to have an interview about this book.
Well, I promise you, my goal is not to make you cry here today. My goal is, as we talked about, is just to get to talk honestly about being human and the ins and outs of that we don't often talk about in public. And it's just an honor to get to sit here and do that with you.
Oh, well, this book is really a gift. I feel like this, the way that you have communicated about love and companionship, I want to get into the details of it, of course, but I just feel like the way that you have communicated that this is not a marriage book. It's not a parenting book. It's not a friendship book, right? It's a book about companionship and relationships. And this goes across the spectrum, as we, as children of God, learn how to live with our neighbors well, right?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I was just, you know, it's interesting. My first book, Lovable, was really about unconditional love, God's unconditional love. And I actually, when I started to work on True Companions, I thought it would be about the concept of unconditional love in marriage. But what I found myself really surprised by and delighted by was this idea that we often think our humanness gets in the way of us loving each other well. And that I just got enthralled, just wildly attracted to this idea that our humanness is actually a vehicle for loving each other well, that it's a gift in and of itself. And so that's what this book became about. And it was a joy to write because of that, and just a blessing to be here talking about it.
So I really would love if you could get us started with the difference in those Greek words, because I've got two comments before I ask you to answer that question.
Sure.
The first one is, I was talking to my husband. I was going to ask him to read it, and I probably still will. But the truth is, I talked with him about it so much while I was reading it, there won't be really any surprises for him when he goes through it. But I forgot even what our circumstance was the other day. And I said something to him, I looked at him, and he said, "Honey, I just philea you right now." Like, he's like, I'm just really there with you. And he was half joking, but he was listening to me as I was talking with you about your book.
Yeah.
Or talking with him about your book. And the second comment I have is, I'm super, super jealous of the explanation that you give with Peter and Jesus with these love, because this was a discussion question in my Greek class last year, and I totally could have used this.
Wow, that's awesome.
But we all kind of inflated, but part of it is reading the Bible even with companions, right? We're all going to kind of see things differently. And so I really appreciate your take on that. So now that I have like hopefully primed the pump here and maybe confused people, can you talk to us about those two Greek words that encompass that unconditional and what you're calling this companionship love?
Yeah. Well, I think when I started to realize that this love that I was going to be writing about in this book, that I call companionship or true companionship, was somehow earthier and grittier and more human than the love I'd written about in Lovable, it caused me to remember that, hey, the Greeks had a bunch of different words for love. And I wonder how all those play out in the context of thinking about this. And so they had four words for love, but the two you're talking about, agape, is the Greek word for unconditional love. And when the Greeks used it, and indeed when the writers of scripture used it, they almost always used agape to refer to God and to God alone, or to the gods in some cases with the Greeks. It was considered to be the property of the divine. But then they had this other word, which was philia, which was this idea of, and this is the root of the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. And the idea that this is a love that is built around doing life together, companionship together. It's a very human kind of love. And as I started to work through the ideas in True Companions, I realized that I often just assume agape is a better love, and that philia is somehow subordinate to it. And in the writing of the book, realize that they sit next to each other. But the difference being that one is the kind that you live out in human skin, you know, with each other in time and in space and in doing life together. And that concept began to enrich my marriage so much more, actually, than the concept of agape had. Like, I'm always failing at agape. I'm always failing at loving my wife unconditionally. I mean, you could tell from reading the book, I think she's about the most amazing thing God's ever created. And yet I'm constantly making small judgments, resisting who she is, you know, all of these sorts of things. And so to ask in the moment, what would it look like not for me to love her unconditionally, but to be a true companion to her right now, just opened up new vistas. And all of a sudden it was something I could do. And so just as you can tell, I'm very excited about the idea of companionship and the way the Greeks have differentiated the two for us.
Yeah, I would say my biggest takeaway from the book, and you talk about it in the intro, but as I looked back and kind of was trying to prepare for this and kind of outline my thoughts and stuff, the thing that I took away from this idea of being a companion and loving each other in a companion kind of way is this idea of witnessing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, kind of on a lighter note, there was this old like Mad TV skit, like that my husband and I still quote. Like, I don't know if you know the one I'm talking about. He's like, "Look what I can do! Look what I can do!" Right? It's just, he's
totally.
You know the one, right? And it's like, this is what we all want, though.
Oh,
right.
I love it how kids have created a new word. Look it.
Yes.
You know, and it's like from the moment they're in, you know, coming out of it and they can speak a word, it's witness me, notice this, you yes. know. I have my daughter, this was summers ago now. I mean, it was probably 2016, 2017. She would have been six maybe. And I was working in the garage one afternoon. And on a Sunday afternoon, and we had a trampoline behind the garage, and she came around to the garage, said, "Daddy, can you come with me?" And she took my hand and we walked around the back of the garage, and she got on the trampoline and she started to jump. And I was like, "Oh, okay." And then she jumped and I watched, and she jumped and I watched. And finally I said, "Sweetie, what did you want me to see?" And she said, "Me, Daddy. I just wanted you to see me."
Yeah.
And I'm like, that is companionship, is witnessing, just being there to see that, you know?
Being there to see that, and also how you use this idea with your wife at the beginning with your kiddo's messy room, but witnessing life.
The whole train wreck. Yes. All the beautiful stuff and all the out of control, crazy stuff, but just sort of, yeah, traveling through life together and witnessing it together. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that the idea of that, like what you're witnessing is messy, what you're feeling when you're seeing it is gross sometimes, but you're with each other and you're right. It's a grittier love.
Yeah.
It's an earthier love than we think of this kind of up here, agape, kind
Absolutely.
Of angels singing kind
yeah.
of.
That's right.
Love, right?
Yeah, like I feel like, you know, Jesus was God wanting to experience what it's what the creation was like. I mean, there's a lot of, we could probably spend all day talking about the reasons for Jesus, you know, but that's got to be one of them. And to get to come in and experience all the grit and the glory of this wild sensory experience that is being human. And so, so in that way, we sort of get to be Jesus with each other, to each other, is to just sort of witness and see it all together.
Yeah. Cause I mean, it's such a big part of our faith, but I feel like at least maybe the way I was conditioned, Jesus' divinity outweighed his embodiment so much that it made me feel really uncomfortable the first time someone pointed out to me that like Jesus pooped his pants.
I love it. Yeah, that's right.
And I'm like, no, he's God. It's like, yeah, he was God as a baby. He pooped his pants. Think about it, you know? And I'm like, I don't want to think about it, but I have four kids and I've changed a lot of poop, you know?
That's right.
He pooped his pants. I mean,
that's right.
You
that's
know, that's a gritty kind of love, man. That
it really is. I'm trying to censor all my other thoughts about what Jesus did at this point. yeah. So the idea that, you can edit this out. So, I'm like, I mean, he was still wiping his butt when he was 33.
I mean, right?
Right? Like that's, yeah, that's what we're getting at here. But yeah. Anyways, yeah. So.
We won't edit it. I mean, we're a family podcast, but we won't edit it.
All right, sounds good.
but yes, it's yeah, gritty.
It is gritty. That's right.
It is gritty.
Yeah, and I guess I came up in a faith where I was taught that Jesus came to earth because of the problems with humanity. And that's true. But he also came to earth because of what is good about humanity, the experience of being human. And so the idea that that if we don't just sort of get to witness it all together, the good stuff and the gritty stuff together, like we're missing out on one of the big reasons he came. That's exciting to me. It's attractive to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you just said that, I'm like, when God created humans, because I grew up in a faith that was very similar. Right. And so I'm like, but when created humans, one of the things that was pointed out to me in a Bible study long ago, it's this, he created everything and said it was good. Everything is tov.
Yes.
Right? Everything is tov. Mm-hmm. And humanity is tov meod. Like humanity is very good, right? But God didn't create this very good humanity and then become shocked at how our colons work, right? Like, I mean.
That's right. That's right.
He knew this. He designed us, right?
So good.
This is not like a thing for him. You know, he's like, oh man, I didn't think about that. Like, no.
Right.
Like,
I should have made the bowel movement smell like roses. Darn it. Wish I could do that again.
No do-overs, man. You know,
right.
Maybe
right.
That was after the fall. Who knows? But you know, this is it. This is where we are. And you're right that Jesus, he became like us. Like he put on this skin and this flesh and he walked, he had true companions.
Yeah. Yeah. He did. Well, you mentioned that scene on the beach, you know, after he's been resurrected and the disciples are out fishing and they recognize him and he calls them in and he's given Peter those three questions again, right? And I remember going to that for the first time going, I wonder what Greek word for love he used in the original text. And it was even better than I could imagine. It wasn't one or the other. It was both. It was like the first two times he uses the word agape and the third time he uses the word philia. And that's got to be intentional.
Yeah,
and why?
Absolutely.
Because at the end he's asking, will you be my friend? Will you walk with me? Will you do life with me? And that's the beauty of that is it just gives me chills.
Yeah. Because that's the other thing. Like he knew how we were made, right? But at this point in Peter and Jesus' relationship, he knew the screw ups Peter's capable of. Right?
That's right. That's right.
And he's still asking him in this gritty way, will you be my friend?
That's right.
Will you journey with me in this? Like, dude, I know.
Yeah.
You can't handle it sometimes.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and how much more real did that make his promise that he would send the Holy Spirit to know that he's leaving, and yet he's asking me, will I walk with him? Like, he is going to continue to be present in the walk. What a powerful gift that he gave that day to Peter and to the rest of them. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. It's huge. Gosh, that brings me to kind of the first part of your book. I'm just going to highly, highly recommend you guys get a copy of this book. It's incredible. But you break it up into three parts. And now we'll tell Seth, I may have him edit this out because I told you I wasn't going to say it.
Yeah.
With your permission, maybe.
Go for it.
I'm looking at my notes and I'm like,
please do.
Here's what I'm not going to say about Kelly's book. And here it is. That here's the story. You're lonely and then you struggle and then you die.
But yes.
When I was making the outline, that's kind of what it looks like. But I think we've been talking about all this nitty gritty kind of gross part of being human, but the loneliness though, that's real.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a real part of being human. And I love how you address loneliness. Mm. So can you just, I mean, wherever you want to go with that, because there's so much richness there. Part of this, and it's a book on companionship, and you start with loneliness, which just feels so counterintuitive, but it's a really, really good foundational place for us to get our minds before we continue on that journey. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think, you know, you say that you're lonely, you struggle, and then you die. The book is rooted in the faith that every part of the human experience has something redemptive built into it.
Amen.
And so I think we skirt around these hard parts of being human because we assume, well, that looks bad, feels bad at first glance. And so we miss the redemptive elements inside of it. And so a big impetus for me writing this book was, what are the hardest parts of being human that if we actually dug into them could become the fertile ground for true companionship? And so loneliness is to me the foundational one. It's this idea that we enter into most companionship with, I mean, we may not say it out loud, but with pretty much the primary purpose of not being lonely. And so what the dynamic that starts to take shape in relationships is, okay, you're my companion now, whether it's in marriage or outside of it. So now you're supposed to take away my loneliness. But what if loneliness isn't something that anyone can take away completely? What if loneliness has to do with the fact that no one can completely see you because yourself is sort of inside of you where no one else can totally get to? And what if they could see you, but because no one else is exactly like you, they can't totally understand you? You know, to me, that's the epitome of loneliness. I don't feel completely seen and I don't feel completely understood. And so when our companions can't do either one for us, which no one can, we then say, well, you're failing at companionship because I still feel loneliness. And now the companionship, the potential for growth and closeness and connection is cut off. But what if we take a look at that idea of loneliness and say, no companion can take your loneliness away completely because no one can see you and understand you completely. Now what? Now what's the potential in that loneliness? And that's sort of where we go in True Companions. But the first thing that I had to do, I realized this was, it was probably a year before I submitted the manuscript to the publisher. And I think what is now currently chapter 5 was chapter 1. And I went to my online tribe and I said, hey guys, let me tell you how great loneliness is. And they are so supportive of me, and usually they're all claps and thumbs up, and they're like, are you crazy? Right? Like, no, loneliness is this. And so we actually spent weeks online in dialogue teasing out what I meant by loneliness and what they heard when they heard the word loneliness, right? And what they were hearing was abandonment, shame, and isolation. It reminded me of I had a couple a while back who came in for therapy, and they were fighting about whether or not to put the new television in the living room, basically. And they were not getting anywhere with it. So I sat them down, you know, we reminded them of their communication tools, and they started talking, and I was listening to them. I was like, can I stop you guys for a second? And I said to the husband, I said, can you describe the room that you mean when you say living room? And he started to describe it. And his wife goes, well, that's the family room. You could put TV in there. I don't care. And I realized that when I say the word loneliness, people think I'm describing a room that is decorated with abandonment and shame and isolation. And I'm not. I'm describing a room that is at the very center of you, that contains everything that is worthy about you, everything that is most unique and most beautiful. And that's why no one can totally get it. Like, you're the only one who has it. And so it's really important at an outset of the discussion to say, hey, this is what I mean by loneliness. And these other experiences, abandonment, shame, and isolation, they're hard and they hurt, and we do need to work through them and heal and deal with them. But this one, this loneliness, we might be able to discover something really beautiful in it.
Yeah, that was one of the most helpful parts of the book, because I wasn't anticipating that. And so I was in a similar place, but I actually felt myself kind of felt my shoulders relax when I was like, he doesn't mean abandonment. He doesn't mean shame, right? So they're just kind of intertwined. And if we can work, and it was kind of this like progressive revelation almost, right, as I was reading through it going, we can work with that, right?
That's right.
Like, we can work with that, kind of undoing some of these strings. And what was kind of funny, we're not doing a therapy session, but what I just thought of personally was, I was thinking like abandonment and shame were kind of the two biggies for me when I was going through that. But I was invited a week or two ago to join some people that I don't really know at a retreat in a couple of months. And when I chatted more with the person who gave me the invitation, and there, it became apparent that there was most likely going to be some alone time, right? Some time where I was going to purposefully, be by myself. Now, I have a husband and four kids and two dogs.
And you don't get much of that.
I don't get much of that. But given that I don't get much of that, like, that idea should have really excited me, I think, right? Mm-hmm. But then I realized, but that's the isolation part that I think my loneliness was decorated with, right? Because what I was feeling is not, I'm going to be lonely. It's, I'm going to be isolated.
Yes.
Because here, when I want, my husband and I call it I time, like, he'll sometimes, I'm kind of extrovert, and he'll sometimes say, honey, I think what you might need tonight is some I time. Can I take the kids? Right. Because I don't notice it as much, because of kind of how my personality expresses. But I think especially with COVID, we've all just been here. Mm-hmm. Right? For a really long time. And all of us are here. And so what I say I want is to be alone. And even when I try, I don't feel isolated because everyone's just on the other side of the door.
Yeah.
Right. The idea of like going to a retreat somewhere far away that I have to take a plane to get to, and being in a room or a cabin potentially by myself, even though I say in real life that that's what I want, it felt, and I think, bing, it felt isolating, right? Ooh, I don't know if I want to be, quote, isolated, right?
Right.
I think I would like to be alone. That sounds like a joy. But I think what I was feeling, the fear I was feeling, was a fear of isolation.
I think what a great distinction. I've talked about this concept of isolation a lot of times, and you just illustrated it so beautifully, that isolation is aloneness you can't immediately get rid of. Like, you can be alone in your den, and then if the aloneness starts to feel uncomfortable, or it was refreshing and you're ready to be done with it, then you call in the kids, or you take the dog for a walk, or, you have dinner with your husband. But to be alone and to not have any immediate way to dispel that aloneness is isolation. And we aren't wired for a ton of that. Like, we are actually wired to be in community, to be able to be connected with people. So you're going to have more isolation than you've been accustomed to. But this is increasingly becoming a, I hate to use the word epidemic in our world these days, given what we're going through, but of people who don't have an immediate way to be seen. And social media, notwithstanding, because it doesn't really feel like it counts oftentimes. And so you do have isolation growing in our world. No one who can kind of just call you up and we can go out and grab a cup of coffee and see each other. So I appreciate that distinction. And isolation is different than aloneness, is different than loneliness. And those differentiations actually help us understand what to do in each situation.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one of the stories shared in your book about one of your sons, maybe, and isolation. Now, I cannot immediately put my finger on it, but if you can, because you were talking about, I think you were talking about how, I didn't note this one, but I think you were talking about like kind of that difference in how we feel and how we can unintentionally kind of, I don't want to say push someone into that place, right?
Yeah.
But yeah. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely.
In that context?
Absolutely.
I hope I set you up. That was kind of vague.
I think you may be talking about the difference between cross country and
Yes. That was the one. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, currently my 17-year-old, he was probably, you know, 13 at the time. He was running cross country for the first time, and I kept referring to it as track, which are very
different
sports.
That one
sports.
Felt a little personal to me, actually, because I did both.
Yeah,
so
you
I can't
both.
Believe I couldn't remember that was the story because I did both, and that is an affront
yes,
to a cross-country runner.
It totally is, and I'm sure that's why you remembered. The story was stuck in there, even though you couldn't. And so, yeah, like he, at first, when I kept saying track, he would, you know, be like, Dad, it's cross-country. But by the time end of the season, when I was still doing it, he was feeling isolated. There was no one seeing, I wasn't seeing him. You know, I wasn't doing the basics of what it takes to be seen. And I think it's in that chapter, I share the story of not too long after that, having scheduled like my first ever self-hosted retreat of my readers who were going to come and out to Utah, and found out maybe 3 months before the retreat that my son was going to be the lead in Newsies in the spring musical. And I started to figure out all these different ways that maybe I could, you know, do the retreat and get there for the last show and all this stuff. And I'll never forget my wife saying, yeah, we could probably get back for Sunday, but there's no way to recreate, you know, Friday night on Sunday afternoon. There's no way to recreate opening night at the last performance. And to me, that was powerful. It was a way of saying, you got to be there in the seats watching and seeing. And so hopefully what reduces there a little bit, if I can be there for him in that way, is his sense of isolation is reduced to somebody that he can kind of turn around and know is witnessing his life.
Yeah. Because I think it's important that you, because we're in the section on loneliness, right? We're talking a lot about not being alone, right? Seeing one another and things like that. But I think the phrasing that you use in the book is that the loneliness, because the question is, how do you become a friend to your loneliness, right? But the phrasing that you use that helped me answer that is that your loneliness is the shadow side of your uniqueness. Right? So talk about the good things about loneliness.
So by the way, we just sort of stumbled upon a good example of the difference between unconditional love and companionship, because I can go to my retreat and miss Aiden's spring musical and tell him and truly love him unconditionally and tell him how wonderful I think he is through and through and how much I'll be there for him no matter what. But companionship is getting to that show, right? So that's a good distinction between the two. So loneliness, the shadow side of our uniqueness. I was just sort of curious in writing it. I was like, I wonder like how unique really is every human being. I mean, you hear like we're 99.9% similar to, you know, monkeys, like how unique can each one of us be? And so when I did the research, I discovered that each one of us has 3 million unique variations on our genetic strand that no other human being has. 3 million ways that we're completely unique. And so that brought to life this idea of how truly unique we are. I mean, you combine that with the fact that none of us have lived the same story, and no wonder there's no one in the world that can totally understand you. And so this idea that you just can't, they're two sides of the same coin. If you're unique, you're going to be lonely, and loneliness is going to flow from your uniqueness. And for that reason, we don't want to get rid of your loneliness, because it would be to eliminate your uniqueness, all these things that make you uniquely you. And so to me, it started to become a way of celebrating when it happens, when my loneliness truly happens as pure loneliness. It's like, oh, here I am. This is me being just me, and no one else can get it. And now I don't have to fight my wife when she doesn't get me, because this is just the shadow side of my uniqueness happening. And I need to learn how to move toward that, accept it, befriend it. I just had a friend who reached out to me and said, hey man, you saved my night at a party the other night. Like, I would have felt terrible, ashamed, bad about myself. I would have left early. I might have gotten defensive and attacked the people there, because no one got me there. And instead, I just sat back and went, oh, this is loneliness. This is my uniqueness. And so I'm just going to embody my uniqueness tonight and let it be. And so to me, that's a great example of moving toward that, rather than trying to fix our loneliness by doing something about it that won't work anyways.
Yeah. When you're talking about the stats on that, and it didn't hit me when I was reading the book, but it hit me just now. I mean, we have identical twins. So our daughters are identical twins. Right. And we weren't for sure if they were identical or fraternal, just kind of, you know, how I carried them and this kind of thing. And so before they started school, we had their cheeks swabbed, because I thought people are going to ask them, and they look enough alike, but we didn't know for sure. And so anyway, we confirmed that they definitely are identical twins, and they are completely unique, right? This like,
yeah,
you look at this, you're like, you can see their DNA on the page, right? And they share a room. All, you know, like all of the things, right? And these two sisters are, in a lot of ways, just as different as night and day, right?
Absolutely.
This comes out. And so they do have a special experience to be twins that many of us don't have, and we'll never experience that. But even them, like, they don't embody one another, right? They embody only themselves, right? And so even them that are unique as a pair are unique as individuals. And as
a parent, you can see why it's set up this way, that we're all so unique. Like, you celebrate their uniqueness. The fact that they're their own people gives you joy. As a parent, you wouldn't want it any other way, even though they're identical twins. And so no wonder God made it so that we each have 3 million unique variations. That's what it's all about, celebrating that we each get to be ourselves. And yet when we have the shadow side of that experience, our loneliness, we start to think of that as a bad thing. But we don't have to.
No, it's really good. Can we talk about the next part of the butterfly, the next part of my outline, where I say we're lonely and we struggle and then we die. But that struggle goes along with our uniqueness too, because we have these, this was a really hard section, Kelly, these protections, right? Like, why, like, I'm like, why does he have to go here? You know, like, why do you even have to talk about it? Felt really loud when I was reading, you know, some of these sections.
So good. Yeah.
You know, but we've all got them. And so the struggle, tell us about the struggle, because it's not maybe what we would think when we first say the struggle.
I love your honesty about your reaction to the section of the book, because, and I'll come back to why I love it. So the idea is that we each come into the world with what I call a connective self. It's the self that God created for us. It's designed for connection, but at some point it gets hurt. We begin to believe that we're not good enough for connection. I mean, that connection is dangerous, risky, hurts. And so we sort of develop a second self, a protective self. And so we develop these protections to keep us safe. And protections do not like to have a light shined upon them, because then they quit being protective, you know? The reason this section is in the book is that the bulk of the work that I do with individuals and with couples is basically that. like, is to develop a mindfulness and awareness of how am I showing up with my protection rather than my authentic desire to connect. And then if I can be mindful of that and aware of it, I've created just a moment of choice. I think it was Viktor Frankl who said there's a fraction of a second between stimulus and response, right? And that fraction of a second is choice. And so if I can be mindful of the way I'm showing up protectively, then I've created a choice for myself. I remember there was a weekend a while back. No, it was a week. It was a Friday. And I woke up in just a really grumpy mood. Like, and my protections were on. Like, I was being critical of everybody. I knew everything, you know, and I had this vague notion in the back of my head that I was being a jerk for no reason. I just sort of knew it, right? Aware enough of that, but not really paying attention to that notion. And I must have been putting something in the microwave, because when I think of this, I think of the microwave. And I was putting something in the microwave, and my wife just says, "Why are you being such a jerk this morning?" And I was mindful that she was right, mm-hmm. that I was being protective and attacking in ways that nobody deserved. And she gave me she brought that into awareness, and I was aware of it, and I had a moment of choice. And I remember, because I don't often choose well in those moments, the protections don't go right. But in that moment, I just said, "I don't know. I'm sorry." And then, like, moments later, I'm like, "Oh, I know. I'm speaking at a large event today, and I'm feeling vulnerable and anxious about it. So I'm gonna just, you know, bluster and act like I know everything, just to feel a little bit more protected." But yeah, that moment of choice of like, "I don't know, good call." And so that to me is why it's so important, is that most of the day-to-day work of relationship is really just, am I showing up with my protections, and can I just create a choice to let them go? I mean, it's, to me, it boils down to, it's almost that simple.
Yeah. When you say that, these protections that we have, they're, my husband's a hugger, and, it's not really that much of a hugger. And, so he used to, early in our marriage, kind of call me like a cactus. He's like a little prickly, right? Prickly. But it's protective, right? I mean, it can be protective. And so there's a kid movie. Years ago, this movie came out called The Croods. And there's one line in it where the grandma, she's like, "Hugs are traps," you know, like someone's
hugs are traps. It's a great line.
So that's like the line at our house, right? Like, if I'm feeling particularly prickly, I would call it, you know, I'm feeling particularly protective, he wants to just, you know, give me what my body needs, which is a great big 20-second hug, you know, and I'm kind of like, hugs are traps. Let's not.
Yes.
Embrace. Let's not connect in that way. You know, I'm feeling a little prickly. I'm feeling like you're trying to trap me, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And maybe it's not hugs, But you go through several where we have these that we can, if we're self-aware, we're gaining self-awareness. We can see these in ourselves.
Yes.
Sometimes we can see them in the people who are close to us, like your wife.
Yeah.
And hopefully in love, call them out and say, "Dude."
Right. That's right.
Why are you gonna be like this?
Yeah. And you know, so when I originally sort of plotted out the book and outlined it, I had listed a number of protections. And then when I finally came around to writing that part, I realized that I had basically just included protections that were common to my personality type, right? Like, I didn't have prickly in there, because that's not my personality type. And so I thought, like, how can I be sure that I've sampled a pretty kind of comprehensive range of protections? And I thought, you know what? The Enneagram is a really great tool. So I'm going to just try to identify the protection that I think is one of the primary protections for each type of the Enneagram. Yeah. And that's how I ended up sort of laying that out, just to try to make sure that I had a range that most people could see themselves in at least a couple of them.
Oh, great. Now and, I'm going to go back and check and see if I can pick my letter or my number.
Right. So I think, what did anger, peace faking, certainty, yesing.
Yes, competing. I had a few of them written down. Yep, competing. Yep. Withdrawal.
Withdrawal, fixing, helicoptering, and excitement.
Yes, and excitement was the one that you said, this is not your MO, right?
No, I think that's the primary protection of the seven.
Of the seven, for sure.
Seven.
Yeah.
And that's my wife. She's an eight with a seven wing. And
you're married to an eight.
I am
too, man. It can... I just, I'm feeling you right now. Like it's, for me, it's a little.
Oh, there's never a dull moment. Let's put it that way.
When I realized that was his yelling, like sometimes now I'll be like, babe, you're like 8 talking right now. I'm going to need you, like, it's early and I haven't had my coffee and I need you to pull it down just a little.
So you know what I discovered here not too long after too many years? Number one, one of the things I love about an 8, and I've always said this about her, is I just never have to wonder what you're thinking.
Please, yes.
Like, oh always. My gosh. Yes. I grew up in a house where I didn't know what anybody was really thinking or feeling. I never have to worry about that with her. But I also realized that when I was doing my, I'm going to communicate in a healthy, constructive way, she experienced that as disengagement. She experienced that as not really being interested. And so I realized that actually at the beginning of a thing, I needed to sort of get in it a little
bit. She kind of wanted a little bit. Yeah, I mean, like, not a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, like show me you care. Like yeah, get a little fired up here. Yeah. So if I do that at first and then sort of now she knows I care. And now I can try to bring my particular style to the communication. So anyways, yes, marriage to 8s is interesting.
I love it. It's so much fun. I actually particularly love when I learn that women are 8s. And so I love that you're married to an 8 who's a woman, because my framework for that is my husband. And so I kind of see this come out in a masculine way a lot of times.
Yep.
And when I just learned, one of my dearest friends, she just kind of learned that she is an 8, and she's really healthy. But I was kind of like, oh my goodness, I never would have pegged you. Right. But she's kind of like, yeah, you didn't know me when I was 19. Right. I'm like,
I always sort of feel bad for 8s, because you just did exactly what, like, my wife's an 8, but she's healthy. Cause when you think of an 8, you don't think of a healthy 8. You just think of somebody who's just
off the handle sometimes.
Off the rails. Yeah, so it's so funny you said that. Yeah.
Yeah. I will tell you though, I do love being an 8s person.
Yeah.
Like that feels like, for, I know this isn't an Enneagram talk, but I'm like, for a 6 who like really desires security, like being an 8s person feels really safe, you know?
Well, and that's like, I think a lot of people don't realize that the 8's anger at its healthiest is always in defense of the underdog.
Right.
Always in defense of their people. And so, it's amazing to be married to an 8.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We just had someone came to the door the other day about they're wanting to change something on the Homeowners Association. Right. And I'm like, I have a master's degree in social justice. Right. I'm like kind of aware vaguely, at least I try to be, you know, kind of what we talk about on the podcast and things like that. And they come and they say, hey, we're going to make these changes. Would you sign this thing? And it's like, we're trying to bring groceries in and we're trying to get baths in. It's kind of all of the things happening at the same time. So I bring the form to my husband and I say, look, they want to do this. And this is one of the stipulations. This is the other one. And he just like looks me straight in the face. And he, in his 8 talk, he just goes, absolutely not. I will not do it. Send it back. Yeah. And I was like, all right then. That's right. I don't have to wonder. We're done, you know? And I was kind of like, I don't know. I was kind of looking at the nuance of it, you know, and of course he does that as well, but his immediate reaction was no. Next. I was like, okay, well, that
absolutely.
Good.
Yes. We'll
just move on, you know?
I've learned to, and we can segue back to the book, but I've learned to, that when I'm sort of caught in a spiral of indecision about something, why am I wasting time here? Go ask her opinion. Please. And she'll be like, yeah, that's what
exactly.
I do.
Exactly. I love it. It's admirable. But we all, even 8s, right? We all have these protections.
Yeah.
That. And so the struggle is real, but the struggle, you're not talking about this struggle with our companions.
Yeah.
You're really talking about the struggle with our own protection that keeps us from being a true companion.
Yeah. You mentioned the butterfly metaphor that's sort of threaded throughout the book. And the idea is that in the loneliness part of the book, a caterpillar retreats into its own lonely space in order to become the beautiful thing that it's here to be. But then once it's grown, it now needs to leave that protection that it's created while it was growing. And so we have all created protections over the course of our journey and as we've been growing to keep us safe in that process of growing. But a butterfly then comes to the point where they got to push their way out of those protections. And one of the fascinating things about it is that a butterfly can only grow strong enough to fly if they've pushed their way out of those protections. It's the struggling against the cocoon that makes their wings strong enough to fly. You can't help a butterfly out and cut it out, or it'll just never be able to do what it's here to do. And so to me, that's the struggle. It's not with my partner's protections. It's the struggle against my own, how to push my way out of them and show up as myself. And it's that very struggle, which is making me strong enough to love, really. That's how I learn how to love. And so again, this idea of struggle, the redemptive piece of it is that the struggle itself is how we grow strong enough to show up as ourselves and to be who we are and to do what we're here to do. And so if we can redirect our energies from pointing out, this is what you do to protect, this is what you're doing to defend, and instead turn that attention to ourselves and be aware of that in ourselves, then, and if we can have two people who are mutually agreeing to do that, like, it's off the hook. It's amazing. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was, I mean, it was kind of loud, the portion of the book, but it was good. I was thankful for it because that's what we want, right? We want to be more self-aware so that we can come through with our true selves.
Yeah.
So the redemptive part of the last part of the book.
Yeah.
This, I hope this doesn't leave me, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but this was what I took away from the last part was, like, out of all the things we talked about, God created that are good, and we're very good. And part of this very goodness of this embodiment that we get from the Lord is that we get to realize that our days are numbered.
Yes. I love the way you just said that. We get to realize that our days are numbered. It's a blessing.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. There's a word for a phenomenon in psychology, and it's called habituation. And habituation is the reality that if a stimulus is constant and safe, we quit paying attention to it. Our nervous system basically says, I don't need to waste any more time paying attention to this. It's constant and it's safe. So our clothes are a great example of that. When we first put them on this morning, we felt them briefly. And then our brain said, constant and safe, don't pay attention to them anymore. You know, I mean, you light a candle in a room, right? And smells great for an hour, and then you don't smell it anymore. And then you go out to the garage and you come back in and you go, oh, wow, it smells good in here. And so the reality is if our companions are constant and safe, the two things we're asking of them, we are going to start habituating to them. We're going to start taking them for granted. And so, like, when someone says you're taking me for granted, you can say, that's the best compliment I could ever give you. You're constant and you're safe. But we will one day wish that we hadn't taken them for granted, that we'd done something to disrupt that sense of habituation. So one of the things, the thing I talk about in True Companions is that there's a line of research that says basically the only way to consistently disrupt your habituation is to prime your fragility, to be aware that your days are numbered. This gift that we've been given, that we can anticipate that and be aware of it. And that perspective, that your horizon is actually, you know, not infinite, and that your days are numbered, actually leads to an entirely different set of values that surface within us and a different quality of attention. We value deepening our relationships with our closest companions, paying close attention to our lives, and enjoying ordinary everyday pleasures. And without that awareness of our fragility, we slip right back into habituation and just sort of coast through life. So what a gift our fragility is.
Man, this was an incredible section. I had so many thoughts while I was reading this. You know, one of them was, this was, when I was a kid, and I think we all, maybe not all of us, but it's not uncommon, right, for kids to be like afraid of death, right? Or even for grownups to be afraid of death, right? And that was like one of my, this was what kept this anxious child up at night, right? And I turned 40 next month. And so this kind of, oh, like, here we are, like, You know, when my husband first said something about me being in midlife a few months ago, I almost smacked him. But I'm like, but he's right. I mean, it's I'm not right. 28 anymore. Uh-huh. This memory making, right? I remember when my mother-in-law, she's actually passed away now, but she used to talk about that. Like, I just want to make these memories, you know? And in my head, I'm kind of rolling my eyes. I'm thinking, you're such an old person, yeah. right? Like this, that's such an old person thing to say, but I regret that, you know, I regret that even that emotion tied to that but I just didn't have the life experience that she had to understand that these memories are really valuable. And hers even saying, I want to create memories. She's doing exactly what you're suggesting, right? She's getting in touch with this fragility that we have and recognizing and sadly she's saying these kinds of things before she was diagnosed with cancer. Right. You know, she was getting in touch with her fragility. Right. And had I done the same, I would have, you know, probably made some different decisions, but, it is this whole section of the book when you're talking about that, it also made me think of, I don't know. I'm wanting to say the word legacy, but that's not really what I mean, but, you know, but being able to have that continue with our companions, because I mean, you know, you talk about that, like there will be a time, like my husband's real sweet and romantic. And he always says, he doesn't tell me he's going to love me forever. He always tells me he's going to love me until one of us dies. Right. Yeah. <'Cause> he's super sweet. Romance is his gift.
And, he and I would hit it off. I have this mortality consciousness that I can't shake. I often joke that I don't understand why we say hi to each other. I think we should say, you survived. Like, I don't understand. Like, how are we all getting through a day?
Right. So he's going to love me until one of us dies. And I'm fine with that now. But we used to be a part of a tradition where when someone would pass away, what we would say is, may their memory be for a blessing.
I love that.
And I think that's just so rich, right? Yeah. Because it recognizes this, you know, this companionship that we're missing now, but it recognizes, I don't know, like those, the memories, the paths, help me. It puts a name to that.
Oh, there's a lot there. So the first thing that comes to mind is there was a year where my New Year's resolution was simply that when I walked in the house, it would be a net positive for the family. You know what I'm saying? Like that.
If I could do that for a week, bro, I'd consider that a win, right?
I don't know. It was probably one of those that didn't get to, you know, there were still people going to the gym when I gave up on that one. But, you know, and that's what I think you're saying is that, I mean, what a beautiful vision for one's life, that I would live in such a way that my memory is a net positive, that it's a blessing to those who remember me. But I think it's important to say around this too, that, because I think one of the reasons we hesitate to go in this direction is how much potential regret is also woven. And you mentioned the story with your grandmother, right? Like, as soon as I start to become aware that life is precious and short and fragile, I'm now also aware of all the times I haven't been aware of that and how I've been habituated and I've been on autopilot. And so one of the things I like to encourage people to remember in this regard in particular is that regret usually is just resistance to the fact that you're ordinary. That of course you habituate, and of course you're now aware that you need your fragility primed in order to really appreciate your people in your life, and you will forget it by next week, and that's okay, that's ordinary. But if you've set on the whole your goal of being more aware of this trajectory of every human life, then on the whole, you're going to be more aware. And that's what we're aiming for. But goodness gracious, we're all ordinary. We're actually wired to just go on autopilot and quit thinking about it. And so don't try not to beat yourself up for that. Just when you remember, start to be aware again, really.
Oh, I love that. I love that so much. I mean, we've hit the main outline of the book, but I really can't recommend it enough. I'm going to tell everyone what I told you before we started recording, which is I'm an avid reader. People who I'm blessed enough that listen to the podcast on a semi-regular basis know that I read every book, essentially that we have guests on, and I love reading, but this will be one I come back to. Like, I anticipate coming back to this one because I want to see how it hits me next year or the year after. So I'm saying that to say we've hit kind of the outline and some of the high points, but man, this is so rich. There's so much meaty, good stuff in here. But saying all of that, Kelly, where would you want to leave us? Like, what's the question that I didn't ask? Is there anything left in you that you're just like, if I could leave people with this thing, it would be it?
That's a really good question. Well, let's just keep following the flow. The book concludes with me sort of imagining my own inner reunion of all the companions that have sort of walked with me along the way. And I think when we talk about such things that we come to initially heavily, right? Loneliness, struggle, mortality. I think it's important to also just make some space for celebration, and to celebrate. It was amazing. So the concept is that you sort of carry your companions around with you, and they're all there inside of you. All of those memories and experiences. And if we can just be still long enough to sort of connect with that, I was amazed at the people who showed up at my inner reunion. And there was a tremendous sense, because I've gone through much of my life feeling very alone and lonely. And I came out of that exercise going, I was never alone. Like, I've been blessed by so many companions that I've taken for granted, you know, people who came in for a season or a year. And so I just would invite listeners into this opportunity to just take some space and reflect back on your story through the lens of companionship, and just ask yourself, who are the companions? You know, it's a teacher that said that thing that made you fall in love with English. It's a mentor, an advisor who walked with you for a season. It's a sibling who maybe didn't live in the house for long, but for a little while, you know, you played basketball in the driveway every night in the summer of, you know, 82. And these are the people that sort of populate our lives. And so I just encourage listeners to take some space to celebrate the companions in our lives.
Thank you so much, Kelly. Where can we find you online? Do you hang out? Are there places where people can connect? And I'll put links to buy the book, of course. Where else can we find you?
Sure. Yeah. So thank you for asking. So my website is drkellyflanagan.com. It's drkelly Flanagan, FLANAGAN.com. And it's a great place to start. When you get there, there's a big button at the top that says Get Your Guide. It's a 52-week guide I've created that can actually serve as essentially like a weekly devotional and practice for your entire year, walking you through the cultivation of worthiness, belonging, and purpose. And so it's a great place to start. You'll almost never get more than one monthly email from me. And this is really exciting. It's the first time I've announced this anywhere other than to my own sort of tribe. We have scheduled, I want to say it's October 15th of 2022. We're going to call it Companion Camp. And it is going to take place at the 4U Ranch in Peoa, Utah. It's for the number U, the letter ranch. We did the Lovable Retreat Weekend 2019 there. And it is, I'm not even going to try to describe the place to you. Because my wife and I are going out there in October to spend time with Donna and Gary Urban, just to enjoy them and to talk about Companion Camp. And you can't comprehend how cool this place is till you walk onto the property. It's just amazing. So if you're interested in maybe doing that, coming to Companion Camp 2022 and getting together with like-minded people talking about all these things and growing through them, then just going to the website and subscribing is a great place to get connected.
Awesome. Oh, that's exciting. Yeah, I'll put that on there. I mean, my husband is a geologist, and one of his favorite places is Utah, right?
Is that right?
He loves being in that part of the country because the nature is just so beautiful there.
So these two, they had jobs in California, and when they retired, her dream had always been to start an event ranch in Utah. And so they have 70 acres outside of Park City, and they have the most gorgeous event barn. They host weddings every weekend. It bumps up against these mountains. There's a river running through the backyard. It's just a gorgeous, it's just an incredible place. So we're really excited to do companion camp there.
Oh, that's fun. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, I will put all of those links in the show notes for everybody. And gosh, Kelly, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. This has been amazing.
This conversation was truly a blessing to me. Thank you, Alexis.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.